Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the third episode of the new season of Sukoon. Sukoon is going through a reimagining into a new series brought to you by Nasimco, where we explore the rich history, challenges, and successes of the North American Shia Muslim community. In each episode, we'll sit down with leaders and pioneers who have helped shape our community, contributing to its growth and development over the years. Today, we are honored to have with us someone who has been a pivotal figure in the development of the Shia community at large. He works tirelessly in helping others when they need assistance and is a consistent force of good in making a positive name for the Shia community. Rahat Hussain is an attorney, author, and nonprofit leader focused on Shia Muslim advocacy, interfaith engagement, and Islamic education. He serves as the executive director of the Shia Muslim Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based 501c3 organization dedicated to promoting the rights and welfare of Shia Muslims worldwide. Under his leadership, the foundation addresses issues such as sectarian violence, civil rights, and the marginalization of Shia voices in global policy conversations. Rahat has attended numerous high-level meetings at the White House with the Obamas, Trump's and Biden administrations on a variety of issues of importance to Shia Muslims. A longtime advocate for civic engagement among American Muslims, Rahat has organized high-level meetings with U.S. senators, members of Congress, federal agencies, and global religious leaders. He previously served as advocacy director at the Universal Muslim Association of America and as executive director of the Islamic Information Center, where he led policy work on religious freedom, civil rights, and international human rights. Rahat is also a published author. His books include A Muslim's Guide to Happily Ever After, Muslim Elementary School, The First Grade Studies, The First Imam, Journey to the Heart of History, and The Fire People. His writing blends accessible Islamic education with contemporary challenges facing Muslim communities. He holds a JD from the University of Maryland School of Law, an MS from Georgetown University, and a BS with general honors from UMBC. Salaams, Brother Rahat, and thank you for joining us today.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to being part of the podcast today.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you were born, educated, your career choices, and why you went down that path?
Yeah, you know, so I was born and raised here in the U.S. And, you know, my first career inclination was to go into IT. And I explored an internship at the Verizon Next Generation Technology Lab. And it was fun and it was enjoyable, but it was more of a hobby for me rather than a real career. And then after that, I thought, let me explore medical school. So I actually went to the St. Louis University School of Medicine for about 2 years. But that also just wasn't for me. So one of the problems I had was I was very academically successful. And I think for a lot of people, if you're good at one thing, that's the career you pursue. And it's very easy. And you just pick that and you go down that route. For me, it was a little bit different because I was successful academically in different areas. So I wasn't really sure which way to go, what to do. So after med school, I thought, you know, I'm a little bit too old to not have a master's. So I went and got a master's in biochemistry with a focus in biotech at Georgetown. And I met a few lawyers there and I was quite confused. I was like, you know, what are you doing? You know, you're already lawyers. Why are you in school still? And they told me about patent law. And I thought that was a great, you know, segue for me, you know, combining my interest in policy with my background in science. Then I became an attorney, and then I was very specialized for the first part of my career. I was very focused on biochem, biotech, patent law, pharmaceuticals, and the like. But over time, I became more generalized until I started exploring many other areas of law. I became involved with Islamic organizations, started off with IIC, kind of in a lower role. And the idea was, let's just educate government about Shiism. Then, you know, we have this belief, of course, that Imam Mehdi's going to come and he's going to fix the world and save the world. But how sad is it that that's going to happen? And these people, if it happened today, they would say, "Who are you? We've never heard of you. We don't know what's going on." Even if they had the best of intentions, they literally have no knowledge of that. So the purpose of IIC was to provide that information, that education. Then I moved over to Oman. I thought, you know, it, it Of course, the information is important, but we have a community here and we're being left out of important conversations that are directly impacting the Shia community. And that's not happening to the Sunni community. They were involved in discussions at a high level for the last 20 years. They're becoming more and more involved. They have the support of numerous international governments. One of the reasons, we talk about, why is the Shia community so much less advanced politically? Why do we not have larger institutions? Is that, Sunni countries support Sunni organizations in the U.S. At a very high level. I mean, there's 52 Muslim countries in total, and at least 30 of them are funding Sunni organizations in the U.S. to engage in political activism. In the U.S., I would say there's in the range of 5 to 10 major national Shia organizations, and none of them are being funded by foreign governments. The Shia countries are not in a position to do that. And, because of our interests and our focus, I don't think we even want that. So it's really created a situation where the Shia community, we're just starting our journey into politics. And even though we're just starting, we've only been doing this for 5 or 10 years, we have to be at the same level as organizations who have been doing this for more than 50 years. We have to have that level of expertise. We have to have that level of institutional knowledge. So we're playing catch up, and at the same time, we're trying to pretend like we are the experts. But I think the more as our community grows, the more we become educated about what's happening in the world and how we can impact that, it'll make a big difference. But the community is, we'll get on into that in the next part of the discussion. But I fear that we don't think of ourselves as Americans. We don't think of ourselves as part of the West. We still think of ourselves as immigrants who are, we should just duck and hide in the corner. We have to use strategies that were more effective in South Asia and the Middle East, and we can't use Western strategies to advance ourselves in the Western world.
Yeah. How did your parents feel about you leaving medical school after 2 years?
My family's always been, pretty supportive. They knew it wasn't
Yeah.
right for me. I think many, many Desi families would be very astonished by it, but my family is very
Yeah.
supportive.
That's good.
They didn't care what I did
Yeah.
specifically, but they did care that I pursued whatever field to the highest
Yeah.
level.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of push for ambition that drove them, but at the same time, they still supported my decision to leave.
Yeah. I think when you mentioned that, we're afraid to see ourselves as Americans, I think there is that fear from a previous generation that if we view ourselves as Americans, we lose the other identity. Like, how do you be a Shia Muslim American, that multi-hyphenate? It's like if I involve myself in American politics, then I'm admitting I'm American, which means I can't be as Muslim. I think that's a struggle that some people might have with that multi-hyphenate.
Yeah, I think being American or being, Western or European or Canadian, I think gives you more opportunity to be a more authentic Shia Muslim. Our countries, India, Pakistan, other countries, we've mixed culture so much with religion that
Yeah.
for many it's hard to draw the line. Whereas in America, it's not like that. There's no concept of mixing American culture and confusing it for religious Shia belief. So I think because of that line, it helps people understand their identity, understand our religion, our beliefs, and not only that, affirmatively choose that this is the path I want to take. I actually want to be Shia. I actually want to learn our beliefs and follow it to a very strong degree and practice it in my life.
Yeah, that's a really important point. Did those career choices and going into law lead you to starting up the Shia Muslim Foundation? And could you talk a little bit about the organization in case people aren't aware of it?
Yeah, so the Shia Muslim Foundation was created in 2020. Previously, I had been with Universal Muslim Association of America, UMMA, and I was doing a lot of the same work. But UMMA, I think, is a much kind of larger organization, and they have many other priorities and objectives. And now, my brother is actually the president of UMMA, so we still collaborate, of course. But I think they wanted to focus on the more community aspects of the organization, not necessarily get bogged down or convoluted with political work, community work, social work, charitable work. It was just too many things for one organization. So I branched off and created Shamelson Foundation with the idea that this is exclusively focused on civic engagement, political engagement. And of course, it's a small organization, but we've had a huge impact. I maintain a very strong relationship with ulama, both here in the US, in Europe, and in the Middle East, that helps guide our organization as to what we want to do. And one of the main focuses of Shamelson Foundation has been to support our ulama, particularly with immigration status issues politically for the last several years. We've raised the issue of, Shia scholars having immigration issues. We've raised it with the highest echelons of the White House under Trump, under Biden, even, back going as far back as Obama. I guess that was more in the Obama days. But I don't think many people realize that we have a voice, that we can reach the President of the United States. We can walk into the Oval Office and have meetings because of this work.
Yeah, that's an important point when you bring up your relationship with the ulama and their needs, because Muharram will soon be approaching, and scholars who want to come and lecture here, we have to think about what issues they might face given the current climate. So it's important to have these relationships so you can help the
Yeah.
ulama.
So a lot of this stuff, many people don't realize. A lot of these issues, particularly for Shia ulama, started with ISIS. And the US government, they had a logical idea. They're like, all right, ISIS is based in X countries. It's based in Iraq, it's based in Syria, they have ties to Lebanon. So let's limit or reduce travel from those countries to reduce the spread of ISIS influence in the United States. And logically, of course, that makes sense, right? But the problem is, those countries are also historic Shia communities for more than 1,000 years. And so, even though their intention was, let's oppose ISIS, they ended up impacting Shia Muslims more than any other group. And they didn't realize. I spoke with the White House and I was like, hey, listen, this is a major issue, and it's impacting our religious freedom. And, primarily Shia communities are being affected. And, they pointed to, well, we have this serious security problem in the US. In what was it, 2021, 2022, there was a planned ISIS attack in Chicago where ISIS had converted an individual from the Northeast in the US, I think either Connecticut or Vermont. And his plan was, let me go to one Shia center in Chicago, kill as many people as I can. Then I will go, if I don't die myself, I'm going to go to other centers throughout Chicago, Shia
My
centers
gosh.
exclusively, and kill as many people over and over and over until they kill me.
Oh my
And
gosh.
the only reason he was foiled was because the FBI somehow found this guy first, and they tricked him, they trapped him, they arrested him, and he's been convicted. He's in jail for a long time. And so, there are these competing interests that I think even the Shia community would agree with, that hey, no, none of us want ISIS in the US. None of us feel that that's safe at all, especially for Shias. But at the same time, we do have that competing interest of religious freedom. So, we're still working with our allies in government on how do we figure this out. And we can't just say, all right, just let the Shias in, and you can worry about the other people, because that's not logical from their perspective. They don't know who's Shia or who's not, and they don't know, really anything about this. I mean, this goes back to the initial issue I mentioned, that they don't understand what Shia Islam is all about. They don't understand what Sunni Islam is all about. They have a very low level of knowledge. Secretary of State John Kerry, he passionately argued in support of the Shia community. He was an ally, and he said, hey, we've got to respect them. We've got to respect their culture. They believe that Imam Ali died in Karbala.
Oh, wow.
So, this is, for us, it's kind of a very simple mistake. How could you make that mistake? What's going on? At the same time, he was trying to support us. He was trying to say, hey, I'm with the Shia community.
Absolutely.
So there's this huge disconnect in what they actually understand about us, and what our needs are right now.
And when you went in during that Chicago incident, do you feel that at that point the US government in 2020, 2021 had any understanding of the Shias and how we felt about some being persecuted by extreme ideologies on the Sunni side? Or did they not have a concept of it?
They understand that there's issues between the Sunni and Shia and Wahhabi communities. But they don't have a sense of what is the source of the issues. They just see this conflict that's big, and they try to do this kind of both sides issue, where they think, oh, the Shias are fighting, the Sunnis are fighting, both of them have problems, both of them are good, both of them are bad. You know,
Yeah.
it's just very confusing for them. So they just don't get it.
Okay. How do you feel about Shia involvement in politics and civic engagement? Do you have any stats, or do you have a per do you know what percentage of Shias vote or run for office or are just involved even at a smaller level?
Well,
And
I'll
what
tell you,
action should we be taking?
in the 2020 election, there were over 100 Muslim candidates for office, and that was an extremely high number. In the past, I think in one particular election, the highest was 10 or 12 across the entire United States. So for 100 people to run in 2020 was pretty exciting. But at the same time, you know, there's scarier numbers. I mean, Muslims overall just have a much lower voting rate than the rest of the United States. Typically, you'll see Muslims will vote at a rate of approximately 20% of eligible voters will actually vote. And that's for the overall Muslim community. The Shia community is much, much smaller. I don't think we even make it to double digits. I think it's in the range of 8 to 9% of Shias vote. You know, it's a combination of not seeing the importance of it, not understanding the importance of it, or being scared, saying, hey, what if they track my vote and find out who I voted for, and then the other person wins? Then what do I do? But you know, we've got some interesting demographics. You know, we did a census at Ummah. I think it was the only ever Shia community census, and it was a very hard, large number of people that participated, partially because we made it mandatory if you wanted to register for the convention. But we saw, and this was in let me see what year, 2019, the year before. No, it wasn't 2019. It was the year before Trump got elected, 2015. And there were about 35% of individuals said that they were likely to vote with the Conservative Party. About 50% said that they were likely to vote with the Liberal Party. And then the remaining considered themselves independent. So these are, you know, surprising numbers to most. I think a lot of young people think that Muslims and Shias in particular are 99% in support of the Democrats. And that's not the case. I mean, we have a variety of variable statistics in the community about who we support. Going back even 5 or 6 years, I think not only in the first Trump administration, but this time too, there were a significant portion of Shia Muslims who actually voted in support of Trump winning the election and, you know, other Republican candidates for office. I think many people are not really aware of that, and they wouldn't know what to do with that number, really.
I don't know what to do with that number, really. Why do you think that happened, given everyone knows, right? I mean, we know what he's like. Why do you think it went that split?
Well, you know, even though we are Shia Muslims, where, you know, there's Sunni Muslims as well, it's not that we just vote on what is most beneficial to the Muslim community in America specifically. A lot of these people think that Trump, because of his very strong viewpoints, is less likely to be accepting of repressive Wahhabi governments and their policies. Because of his focus on deal making, is more likely to be supportive of peace deals. And there's some truth to that. I mean, just yesterday in the news, yesterday being April 24th, it was, you know, it was reported that Israel had pushed the United States to engage in military action, and then this went all the way up to directly to President Trump, and he rejected that against Iran, and he said, "No, we're going to explore diplomacy." And in the recent weeks, there have been talks that Secretary Rubio has been engaging with the Iranian government, and you know, we have this narrative that, like, hey, you know, there's all this chaos in the U.S., but overall, peace is much better for our community. And so the idea that US is engaging with Iran in a peaceful diplomatic way, even though it's shocking, even though none of us are really understanding of how this could happen or able to predict what will happen, I think the push for diplomacy is pretty good. And I think we should support it. But at the same time, you know, others might say, hey, what about, you know, Palestine? What about other countries? And I think the problem in our community is we tend to think, all right, let me put this politician or this policy in a box. This is a good guy. This is a bad guy. This is someone I support. This one is someone I oppose. And the only absolute good guy that you'll ever support is the imam himself. Everyone else is a person. They make mistakes. They make things that you they do actions that you agree with, that you disagree with. And our community, we need to be savvy. We need to understand that ABC, some from politician, maybe they're with us, maybe they're against us. But if they're with us on a certain specific objective, we should support that objective, even if we oppose other objectives. And I draw the comparison of your friend, your best friend. Maybe they do something you like. You know, they hang out with you, they watch shows, movies, they, you know, you go to the restaurants together. It's fun, right? But maybe they do things you don't like. Maybe they have, I don't know, a certain type of movie that you don't like or whatever. Your friends have different interests than you and similar interests to you. But that doesn't mean that you abandon them and you exclusively based upon the one thing you don't like or the 10 things you don't like. And we have to look at politicians the same way. Politicians, and here's the metaphor that falls apart. They're not our friends. They're not our family members. They're not our community members. They're people who are doing a job. And that job has 100 parts. And if we agree with 10 parts, we should pursue those 10 parts. And if we disagree with, you know, 90 parts, we should pursue disagreement with those 90 parts. We don't have to think of ourselves as exclusively beholden to one political party. We can just support the things we support. And that is how long-term progress happens. You know, a lot of young people think, oh, we're with the Democrats all the way. But you know, there's a lot of things in the Democratic Party we disagree with. Does that mean we should abandon the Democrats? No. I mean, I think we kind of inherently understand we take what we like, we leave what we don't like. And we've got to be the same way with the Republican Party. You know, we take what we like, we leave what we don't like.
Yeah, I think that's a lot to think about, but it also caused a lot of issues within the community. Like if you said, I'm planning on voting, you could get a huge heated answer back from someone at Moss. Like someone they'd be like, how can you even think about voting? So, and then the flip side, it's like, oh, I'm not voting. How can you even think about not voting? Like emotions and tensions were so high that it split a lot of people, it
Yeah,
feels.
people get very emotional about voting. And then there's this whole argument, supporting the lesser of two evils, supporting the greater of two evils, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, you know, I think really the wrong way to envision of voting. You know, if your car breaks, you go to a mechanic and you have to pick between three or four or five mechanics. And whenever that happens, you don't think, okay, let me look into the religion of my mechanic. Let me look into how they deal with other non-mechanical issues, et cetera, et cetera. So we would go into the election, we think, all right, let me look at the akhlaq, the ethics, the morality, the theology of the politician. And if this doesn't match up with my views, if the akhlaq, the ethics, the theology, the philosophy of this politician doesn't match up with my views, not only am I not going to vote for them, I'm going to think it's immoral to vote for anyone at all. And this kind of, you know, thinking, it leads us only to one conclusion, that we can only vote for Imam Mehdi, right? Even if there was a marja, you would probably have people saying, oh my gosh, this marja 30 years ago, he did ABC and I disagree with that and so forth. But, you know, this is a practical decision. This is something that's going to impact your life, just like going to a mechanic would impact your life, just like choosing a contractor would impact your life. You've got to look at the important factors that they can affect and choose what will have the best effect on my life, my community's life, and what is the practical reality of that politician accomplishing those goals?
That's a that's an important way to look at things in a good frame of reference. So at a time when Shias weren't being, even Muslims, you can say in general, weren't really getting involved in politics, what made you say, you know, we need to get involved in politics and take that risk of saying, yes, I'm Shia, and someone saying, well, when they think Shia, they think Iran, they think extremism. Going into the, how did you kind of make that decision?
Yeah, you know, I was growing up, I always thought, you know, hopefully somebody helps fix these issues. Somebody else can do this. Somebody will come and save our community.
Someone else will do it.
Yeah, and as I grew older, I realized there is no one else. If I were to stop, for example, what I'm doing with the Shia Muslim Foundation, what, you know, others in the organization are doing together, then there would be no political Shia presence in DC. There would be no thought of inviting any Shias to any political meetings, any White House meeting, UN. There would be no thought of let's include them in these discussions that directly impact their community. And so if there is no one else, and I think that's been the motivating factor for me. Now, what would happen if there were other organizations? And there are a few other organizations. I'm not saying that we're
Yes,
alone in
of course.
this. There's, for example, Shia Rights Watch. There's others that engage
Yes.
in work. But
Yes.
all of us are working collaboratively. We're all doing different things and we're coordinating. But there's just not enough of us that two groups are doing the same thing or three groups are doing the same thing. Everyone's doing what they can kind of alone. I mean, our community is small in the United States. Overall, I think if you look at worldwide statistics, the Shia and Sunni community is, there's X percentages, there's 30, 40% Shia and 60, 70% Sunni. That's worldwide. In the US, there's 6 or 7 times as many Sunnis as there are Shia. The Shia are a much smaller community in the US. And, they're successful, they're powerful, and they're huge allies. But they're small too. There's over, at the highest number statistic from Pew Research, there's about maybe 1 million Muslims overall in the United States. And 1 million Muslims across a total population of 335 million Americans is it's a third of a percent, right?
Wow,
And
that's extremely small.
yeah, it's a third of a percent. And the Shias are even smaller than that. So, I'm not complaining that, hey, Shias need to create 10, 20, 30 organizations. It's not realistic. It's not going to happen. But we do need more people to get involved and active on these issues. 10 years ago, the idea of sending your kids into journalism was absurd. Muslims can't make it in journalism. Shias can't make it in journalism. Now, with the success of Mehdi Hassan, I've seen so many people in college pursuing journalism degrees, graduating, being successful. Obviously not at Mehdi's level, but they're doing it. They're making it happen. And I
You
think
started somewhere too, though, so.
exactly. And I think we need to see the same thing with political engagement.
But given the current climate, a lot of people are either highly anxious about the situation, or they're just going into the other trap of being like, I don't want to get involved. All politics is bad politics. Like, this American politics is dirty. It's full of like dark money. I'm not getting involved at all. So how do you feel in general, Lore, handling the situation? And is there something more we could be doing to help?
Yeah, we've evolved into a culture of the only thing I need to do is post on social media. I don't need to take any other action. If I can post a story, one of these disappearing stories on Facebook, on Instagram, on Snapchat, then I've done my part. I've spread awareness. I've done something. And then that lulls us into a sense of complacency. Because I posted, I did something. I got the word out there. No one kept me down. But this is, unfortunately, it doesn't accomplish anything. It doesn't accomplish much at all. Most of the people who are posting these are posting to an audience that already agrees with them. Other Shias, other Sunnis, other, supporters of our beliefs and causes. But that's not how you change minds. You go to people who you disagree with and get them to agree with you. Even the Quran says, fight evil with that which is better. You have to actually engage with people that you disagree with. And they're, I use that verse, but these people aren't evil who hold these viewpoints. They genuinely just don't understand. They don't understand what Islam is about. They don't understand what Shiism is about, Sunnism is about, any of it. And that's one conversation, what our beliefs are about. They actually don't understand what our communities are about. There's a study that showed that people who know Muslims are 80% more likely know a Muslim in their actual life are 80% more likely to have a positive viewpoint of Muslims. But there's only 1 million Muslims in the US, right? And we're concentrated in the major cities. So this strategy of, Muslims just meeting people on the street and getting to know them, it would change viewpoints, all right? It would be, statistically, scientifically, it's shown it would make a difference. But we have to go further than that. We have to have an outsized level of influence beyond our actual numbers. So the way to do that is with political engagement. If If you are Muslim, if you believe, if you want better for the Muslim community, the last thing you can do is nothing. It's just, click a few buttons on social media and say, hey, I did it. No, I mean, this is, a strategy of communities in the past where they're like, let me just hide in my homes. I don't want to make a religious statement here, but we know from history there were communities, our own communities in the past, who hid in their homes while something was happening in public and they didn't take a stand. And we say in our madras, we'll never do this again. But we're doing it. We're doing it right now. So I'm not saying everyone needs to go out and run for Senate and all that, but you have to understand the Western system. You have to do your own research, and then you have to actually take action. And the action will be uncomfortable. It will be annoying. It will seem like it's unsuccessful. You're going to go to, I don't know, an interfaith iftar or something. You're going to talk to three people. You're going to feel like I wasted my time. Not a waste of time. You are accomplishing changing people's viewpoints about our people, and that will have a positive result.
So speaking to action, we just on the US side wrapped up an election. The Canadians will have one shortly. Why should anyone vote? Why does it matter? Why does one vote matter? Why should I waste my time and stand in line when, I might get weird stares if I'm a hijabi or, it's just one vote.
Let me answer that by expressing a fear I had before this recent election in the US. There were people, supporting Kamala. There was people supporting Trump, and there were a larger contingent of people saying, I'm going to vote independent. My big fear was that the Muslims had decided were against the Democrats, the Muslims thought were against the Republicans, and those were the only realistic chances of who would win. The worst case scenario, the absolute worst case scenario, is that the Muslims vote and both major parties decide the Muslim vote doesn't matter. Many Muslims in our own community, we've decided our vote doesn't matter. And that's not true, it does matter. But the worst case scenario is that the Muslims vote. We get behind a candidate and they don't care. They're like, oh, that demographic is so small, so uninfluential that my policies don't need to cater to the Muslim community. My strategy doesn't need to cater towards, winning their votes and so forth. That would be the worst case. All right. And that would have lasting impacts for 10, 20, 30 years. Thank God that's not what happened. Trump viewed and views the Muslim support in Michigan as a huge positive impact on his winning of the election this past year, and his policies have supported that. We've heard so much about ICE in so many states and all that, but there's about several hundred thousand Shia and other Muslims in the Detroit Dearborn area. There's almost zero stories of Shias or Sunnis or Muslims being impacted in Michigan. That's a conscious choice the administration made. They said, we're going to reach out to the Muslims. We're going to help the Muslims. We want them to vote for us moving forward. And they're leaving Michigan alone. So,
They aren't leaving alone students who are protesting who are Muslim, just to push back on that idea.
absolutely not. No, they're definitely going after these students and all that. But let me ask you, if they wanted to go after the Muslim community in Michigan, they could raid masjids. They could arrest people on the street. It could be full chaos. And they've decided not to do that. And I'm not saying, hey, that we're in this great situation. We, should be so happy and all that. No, absolutely not. I mean, this is a very concerning situation. But what I'm saying is your vote does matter. If Muslims had voted as a bloc, if they had voted more, if there were more statistics about Muslims overall supporting one candidate or another, regardless of whether that candidate wins or loses, both parties are going to watch that community, the Muslim community, and say, I've got to adjust my policies to make sure I win that vote. Trump's doing it. He's adjusted his policies to make sure he wins the Michigan vote. He's not saying I'm going to support the Muslim community overall. He's not saying I'm going to make it so easy for pro-Palestine, people. He's saying the opposite. But it's clear and undeniable evidence that he's adjusted his policies to win a specific demographic of votes. That's why voting is important. even in this
Yeah.
scenario that we're in this instance of people being jailed and locked up and put away and all that, there's a certain community that's safe, and it's a community that was viewed as an important voting bloc. And so our job, our community job, is to build on that, is to make sure not only does this one politician see us as an important voting bloc, all the politicians see us as an important voting bloc. And yeah, one vote, I don't know. But if everyone says my one vote doesn't matter, then it doesn't matter. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Either you decide that your vote matters and you do something about it by voting, or you decide that we're not important. It's not deciding that
Yeah.
your vote is not important. It's deciding that you are not important. And I think that's way worse as a
Yeah.
mentality. And I think a lot of Muslims have internalized this viewpoint. We don't matter
Yeah.
in America. Of course, we view ourselves as we matter religiously, we matter as individuals, but they think Muslims in America are a weak group, unimportant, and we should not invest in that. And this might not be a conscious thought, but that's how we behave, by not voting, by not participating in elections, by not donating to political candidates. We just think we can't do it. Everyone else is stronger than us and will be unsuccessful. And all of that is false. We are seeing huge dividends for any community, any Muslim community that is politically engaged. And it's important for us. It behooves us. We have to continue that. We have to make ourselves important, and we have to believe in our own importance.
Yeah. But what if when I go to vote, I see the uncommitted movement and I see that that has a, and I think that might have a greater impact, a no vote group.
Well, uncommitted was not a no vote movement. It was a movement essentially that says we're not committed to vote for Kamala. We aren't, you have to get our vote. You have to earn our vote. That was the whole theology of the movement. And it was an effective movement. I think a lot of community members took it as, yeah, let's not vote. We don't need to do anything. We're not going to vote. And that, according to the leaders of the uncommitted movement, was not their goal. They were in negotiations all the time, every single week, with both the Democrat and the Republican parties about what are you going to do to earn our vote? And the philosophy we take, what are you going to do to earn our vote? And then step two is they can earn your vote. You can't create this kind of zero-sum game where no matter what they do or don't do or anything, they'll never get your vote. It's just a waste of everyone's time. You gotta be politically savvy here.
So what does engagement look like before or after elections? And how do you feel about politicians coming into masjids? Do you think that's okay? Do you think masjids should or should not allow for that?
Well, we're only talking about, certain masjids, right? Because in the Middle East, in India, Pakistan, in Khoja communities, we have local politicians that come into our masjids all the time. It's not even viewed as odd or unusual. In fact, it's annoying when they don't come. You're like, hey, this was our holiday. What were you doing? So we should adopt the same mentality here in the US. We talk about preserving our identity and our culture from our home countries. That is a great, fantastic cultural activity that we do that I think we need to encourage here too. And we think, oh my gosh, how can I allow a politician whose viewpoints I disagree with come into my country? But just logically, let's just go to the drawing board. Somebody disagrees with you. You ghost them. I'm never going to talk to you again. How would they ever know what you want from them? I've talked, this has been a theme today. They actually don't know. They don't. They think that, your social media posts are influencing. They're not. No politicians reading your stories on Instagram or whatever. They're not watching TikTok. They don't care. They're like 60 plus year old people. It's a joke, but they actually don't know. I think most people think they know everything, they're so savvy. They are not. They don't know. Even the ones who support our community don't know. And so you have to tell them. And the best way to tell them and to show them is to have them in your centers. And they're even very conservative, very almost extreme Republican Congress people and other elected officials who will come to your center, and it's been shown many, many times they will change their viewpoints when they meet you and get to know you, and of course get to like you. But it is a, you know, it's strategic, but it's also part of our culture. The moms would say, tell them about us, and that's how they'll love us. And we're not doing that. We're not telling anyone about our beliefs. You know, it's not sufficient to be on social media. You have to have the human connection. You have to actually tell people who we are, what we are.
And I think when advocating for especially the Shia faith, if you Google Shia Islam, you don't get the best images. So it's important to have that like in-person connections with people.
I mean, many of us will have friends, right? In at the workplace or whatever. And if you just neutrally ask them, what do you know about Shia? You know, you're going to get weird responses even from educated people who want to respect you. You're still going to get a weird response because they're going to just what they know from the news. And they were interested in the news and they read CNN.com or FoxNews.com and they learned, you know, like a 50-word thing about Shias, and that's all they know. And that's horrible. You know, we're much
I
more.
don't even think I would ask anyone if I'm being perfectly honest, because I'm so scared that someone would just be like, you guys are, if they know anything, it's
Yeah,
nothing.
but here's the thing. They know you, right? They know you as a person. They're friends with you, right? They like you. And they think, oh, they probably think, oh, you're not that religious. You're not like those weird ones. You're not representative. And you know, that's false, right? That we are who we are. We are the community and we are representative. But we're not showing them that, right? We're not on the news. We're not in their social circles showing them what our community is about, what our beliefs about, what our practices are about. And you know, that's a social thing, right? But it's also a very political thing. We have to be doing this with elected officials to show them who we are. And we're not doing that. And I think if we did do that, we would have huge results. Politicians would be on our side. And even in deep South Florida, you know, there's congressmen who will go to masjids and change their viewpoints. They will go be on the side of Muslims. And it's happened many times. And the only reason it's not happening more is because of our community. Our community is shying away. We're getting scared. We think we can't show them that we eat biryani or whatever. I don't know what whatever we're scared of. And we don't do it, and so they don't come, and they think, the politicians think, and sometimes they're right to think this, they don't want us there. They want to be separate. They want to be alone.
We're not friendly.
We're not friendly. Their viewpoints are, and their beliefs are foreign, and incomprehensible.
That's an extremely valued point. And speaking on inviting politicians, what about your thoughts on interfaith work? Because I think there's a lot of work to be done just at the basic level, whether it's between, Shia communities, even, Shia Sunni communities and other interfaith communities. Should we be turning inward and focus on taking care of each other? And what are your thoughts on the interfaith work that has been done that you've seen recently?
Yeah, I think you look at interfaith in the US, and let's make it even smaller, intrafaith. The Shia and Sunni communities here in the US have one of the best relationships in the whole world between Sunni and Shia communities living in one geographic location. It's very normal to go to each other's Eid events, not Eid namaz, but you know, Eid fest, suhoor fest, to go to each other's weddings, people even intermarry. It's considered completely normal to go to your Sunni or Shia friend's house for dinner. It's casual. It's nothing, you know? And that's beautiful. It's so easy for us to get along that, you know, we have and we do. And it's also shown in the organizations. You know, there are quite a few Sunni organizations out there that are fighting for Shia rights. And they're always looking for Shias to involve in their organizations, to involve in their work. And it's hugely successful. You know, we have not just Shia Muslim Foundation, but other Shia groups have very strong and very deep relationships with Sunni organizations that have benefited not just one sect or the other sect, but the whole Muslim community. Now, interfaith, what about, you know, Christians, Jews, etc.? You know, I think it's important work. I mean, the Pope, who recently passed away, he met with, you know, almost He met with two different marjas, Ayatollah Sistani, and he met with Ayatollah Taqi Mudarrisi. He
Yes.
met with several Shia ulama. He met with some of the, I think, Qazwinis. He met with Sayyid Ali Abbas Razavi. And he wanted to get to know us. And it was not, a conversion thing. He wasn't here like, let me meet with a marja and try to convert them to Christianity. No.
Yeah.
It was, I want to meet your community. I want to respect your community. And I want your community to respect my community. So if our marja are doing this, I really don't see the argument against each of us doing this individually.
Yeah. Even during troubling times such as these, do you think it's important for us to reach out to other sides?
Yeah, there was this huge thing about Sayyid Razavi engaging in a peaceful initiative in England just a month or two ago. And they said, hey, how can you engage in interfaith with someone who has been such a strong supporter of Zionism? And they said, oh my gosh, there were ridiculous videos put out about, surrender treaty and this and that. And this was, histrionics. It was emotional sensationalism that was not based in reality. What Sayyid Razavi did was he signed an agreement along with 11 other clergy, including with other Sunnis, with Christians, with, and this may be incorrect, I don't know, but Druze and other religious communities, about, hey, we're going to form a council to monitor Islamophobia and to monitor anti-Semitism. It's a two-page agreement. Anyone in the world can read it. That was the agreement. And this is such an amazing thing. This had never been done in Europe before, where a committee was formed to monitor anti-Semitism. And in 2025, I'm sorry, to monitor Islamophobia. And in 2025, with the state of the world as it is, with Muslims being viewed as villains in almost every Muslim, every Western country in the world, for a Western country like England to create a council to monitor Islamophobia, this is an amazing accomplishment. Our whole community should be proud of this. But, we're self-sabotaging. We're saying, uh-oh, this one participant did something outside of the meeting, before the meeting, outside of the meeting, whatever, that I am against. It was reprehensible. And because I put people in a box, they're good or bad, that person's bad, and anyone who's in a room with them is bad, and the whole thing was bad. So we self-sabotage. That's none of that's true. I mean, yes, this person did engage in those activities, but now that person is supporting combating Islamophobia in Europe. That's an accomplishment. That's a good goal. Except we don't want it. We don't want Islamophobia to be reduced because we want to stand on false principles, false ethics, where it's more important that we just say we're against something than actually saving Muslim lives, actually reducing hate crimes against Muslims. So interfaith accomplishes that. It reduces violence against Muslims. It reduces hatred against Muslims.
Absolutely. So how are you handling the news right now, given in you reside in such a hot spot as well? Like, how are you not losing your mind? Like, if we pay attention to every news alert, it's near impossible. It's so much going on the US side and imagine on the Canadian side as well. But on the other hand, I want to know if someone's taken away. I want to know if our rights are being infringed upon. So how are you mentally kind of handling this balance?
Well, there's a lot of bad news right now, right? We're seeing immigration rights or immigrants' rights being trampled upon. There's scary videos of people being arrested in very unusual circumstances, taken away. There's stories about all of that. At the same time, on the other side of not immigration issues, there's so much with the economy, with tariffs and all that, also scary. I can't even live in my own home in peace, a lot of people are thinking. And that's quite unfortunate, and it's scary, right? Of course it's scary. But there's a question of, did it change? Did these people just come out of the woodworks and now they're here and they weren't here before? Or is it just being revealed? Is this how it always was and we just didn't know? Or did this actually change? And I'm of the mindset that this is how it's been. All right. The Trump has not been accused of doing, with all these activities, illegal activities. These are all under laws that were passed, some of them even 50 years ago. He is using the authority given to him by these laws to do it. And, we saw anti-immigrant activities not only with Trump, but with Biden, with Obama. We saw, I think a lot of the Muslim community got very upset about Palestine after October 2023. But that, it just shows that we didn't realize that same stuff has been happening for 70 years. This hasn't changed. The scenario where everything kind of is stressful and scary and all that, it's not a new scenario. You're just hearing about it more. And so, how do you combat being scared? I think a lot of people are like, well, let me just avoid the news. That's the easiest, most effective way. And no, that's not true. The most effective way is to engage, is to, get to know politicians. Not just you have to go to your congressman, your senator, your local politicians, your school board, your state congress, your mayor, and say, this is my community. We want our rights, and we want you to stand up for us and protect us because we're here and we're not going anywhere. And I think that can have a huge impact. And I think there's also a little bit of, doomsdaying. We think, all right, this is it. It's over.
It is.
But there's some huge news stories that, we can really look at and be happy with. The idea that the US, that Trump himself is pursuing diplomacy with Iran is another one of these unexpected 2025 headlines. But it's a good one, Listen, who's mad about that? I mean, I think there's one country that's mad about it, but our community should be proud of that.
I guess it's perspective as well.
Yeah. And then I think a lot of our community, they follow Iran, They think, all right, they're the leaders politically for us, what we should be doing. They're engaging with the US. They're engaging with the Trump administration. If they can do it, why can't American Shia in America do that?
Yeah, we have to think outside the box. That box that we were talking about earlier, I think it's important to think outside of it.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for younger students, those in middle school and high school and uni, who are kind of in seeing this turmoil and they're like, what the heck does what am I supposed to do with my life, my career? Like, what's really important right now? Back before you would say go into something that makes money and supports your family. But now I think a lot of people are like, I need to do something worthwhile with my life, something that has an impact. Do you have any thoughts or advice for those people?
A bit of a warning first. We'll start off with a warning, which is
Right.
I'm a lawyer, so it comes first to my mind. Do not post anything on social media ever on any topic. Not on these disappearing stories, not on anything. Just because you perceive the story disappears does not mean it disappears. It does not. They store it, they save it, and there is a likelihood, a very strong chance, that it will be used against you. Do not post it. If you must post, innocuous family stuff. But your career will be impacted. Your immigration status could be impacted. Every part of your life could be impacted because you posted something on social media. Don't do it, especially avoid it. And then many people are listening to that saying, well, what about posting about someone's rights or this social group? How am I going to get the word out? You're not getting the word out that way. You're not doing it. It's ineffective. All right. Probably my friends are the same way. I'm going to post five stories every day about Palestine. All right. I'm going to post 20 stories about Palestine. That, even if you post 100 stories about Palestine, you're not helping Palestinians. It is not accomplishing anything. What does help Palestinians? Engaging with them, going to the Palestinians in your community, fundraising for them, charity drives. Engaging with non-Muslim people or pro-Palestine people and saying, hey, they're people too. We can help them. We can support them. But social media, how can I put this? You're like a celebrity. These celebrities that post things and they get in trouble? That's you. You're a celebrity. You're gonna post something, you get in trouble.
To push back, what about the fact that social media has allowed more people to know what's going on in Palestine because of the Palestinians who are they are posting in Palestine? We have found out about journalists dying because of social media.
You can learn from social media without making your posts as your main form of social activism, right? It's definitely good that, these journalists and these other people are going on, different social media informing us about things we did not know about. Citizen journalism is hugely effective, right? But what is not effective is ordinary youth in our community reposting stories or posting very emotional messages about, I hate so and so, I love so and so. It's not helping the people you want to help. And there is a way to help the people you want to help, but you have to actually be active. It's not about clicking a button.
I can't help but feel that that sounds like a little bit of living in fear.
Yeah, it is. It we live in a time where they're going after students. And taqiyya is a part of our religion, and it's a practical part. It's about protecting yourself. And this is a scary response. I'm saying, hey, don't post. And that, it's very unfortunate. It's terrible. But here's where we are. The FBI is raiding student dorms. They're arresting students. For what? That one girl in New York, she wrote an op-ed about something innocuous. I don't even remember the details, but she was just like, let's get health care to Palestinians. And they arrested her and they're deporting her. She's in jail right now. So actually, nobody's being arrested, however, for interfaith. No one's being arrested for contacting their politician. No one's being arrested for engaging in political activity to improve our situation. But they're using social media against us. And remember, who runs social media? China owns TikTok. Zuckerberg owns Facebook and Instagram.
And
Are
WhatsApp.
these people on your side?
No.
Owners of social media trying to help university students? Are they pro-Palestinian? Are they? No, they're none of that.
Well, it's
How do
along with like WhatsApp forwards, a lot of the WhatsApp groups kind
you...
of go in that same route.
Yeah, I think all of us know, but all of us forget Zuckerberg owns WhatsApp too. It's a scary time. And I don't think we should be scared, but we do have to take practical steps to protect ourselves. And that means, realizing that if I want to make a difference on this issue or that issue, I have to actually engage on it. And that security agencies and so forth are watching my social media. And so I'm going to edit my social media accordingly.
Would you encourage a career in law or politics during these troubling times, or would you tell people go into journalism, go into more activism? Do you think it needs to be a little bit of everything? Do you have any
I
experience?
think the real fear would be changing your career based on the current circumstances. If you are passionate about something, pursue it. If you want to be a doctor, if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be an engineer, if you want to be a politician, a journalist, pursue that. Whatever's happening right now, it's not going to be the same in 3 or 4 years. Maybe worse, maybe even better. But you can't modify your plan, your life on the political circumstances of what's going on in the government. One of the, there's a saying that the elections are not decided by knowledgeable people. They're not decided by the most educated voters. Elections are decided by the majority of voters, and the majority of people, they don't read political news. They'll read a single headline once a year, and that is a sum total of their political knowledge. All right, so I'm not saying do that. Don't be uneducated, but you still have to be a part of your community. You still have to live your life, and you have to be successful in whatever field you pursue. So, almost fearlessly pursue your career, make a difference with or without your career in your community. And I think you got to keep going forward with that.
Thank you so much for your time, Bradley Rahat. Your dedication to the community and your insightful reflections give us so much hope for the future. You've set an example that many of us can learn from. To our viewers, we hope this conversation has provided you with a deeper understanding of the roots of our community here in North America and the hard work that goes into building and sustaining it. At NACIMCA, we are committed to celebrating leaders like Rahat and fostering connections that strengthen our community for generations to come. We invite you to continue this journey with us as we bring you more inspiring stories from across the continent. Thank you for listening, and until next time, Assalamu alaikum.